This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, I'm Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, action, exploitation, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1970s to today. Be sure and check out reallyawfulmovies.com for reviews, interviews, lists, and terrific movie giveaways. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 52, Death Force, a.k.a. Vengeance is Mine, a.k.a. Fightin' Mad.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's an apostrophe on the end, but it just sounds better as fightin' mad.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, again, this is a movie with three titles, and, I mean, it's such a hallmark of exploitation films where, you know, they'll title a film one, they'll give it one title for one market, and then they'll give it another title for another market, then they'll see, okay, this market's not doing so well, so we'll pull it, and then we'll title it something else, yeah. And then redistribute it, and it's going to do better under that title. And I fucking love that practice.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish it would do that with, like, you know, The Avengers, you know? It's like, okay, well, it's The Avengers, then let's pull it and call it, like, you know, Hulk Smash or something like that. I don't know, I don't give a fuck. A shitty-ass movie. But, anyhow, let's... this movie, I mean, it's... Well, I guess what we'll call it,
Let's title, go by, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's titled on the DVD case, and this
and
is
it, it's a Vinegar Syndrome
release,
and it's paired with Vampire Hookers, which we're definitely going to podcast at a future date by virtue of the title alone. And we should give a shout-out to Vinegar Syndrome, because mm-hmm. these guys are a distro. That's lingo, inside film lingo we're dropping on here. They're a distributor.
Dropping a little science.
Yeah. They're a distributor that's known for, you know, 70s porn, blaxploitation, and horror. And we had the pleasure of hanging out with a couple of the dudes from Vinegar Syndrome at Shockstock in London, a horror festival.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really cool, and they put out really great stuff, and mm-hmm. this is no exception.
Right,
there's
right.
a guy with a giant afro swinging a samurai sword, and I said, that's where I want to spend my $8, and I picked this up from their booth, so yeah.
Yep, indeed. I mean, when you got blaxploitation combined with, you know, the ancient, you know,
the ancient Japanese art of
Bushido, you know, you're going to have some magic, right?
And there's all sorts of genres thrown into this thing. This is part mafia film.
Yeah.
Part blaxploitation, part revenge film,
mm-hmm.
part what you name it, everything. But yeah, part martial arts flick,
part romance,
part vetsploitation,
part vetsploitation, little part crap, but overall,
mostly.
But just to, you know, talking about the other thing, I'm looking at this particular DVD here. I mean, there is a thematic link between Death Force and Vampire Hookers, in the sense that they're both directed by Sirio Santiago. And, I mean, for those of you that may not know the name, you have seen a Sirio Santiago film, because, I mean, in the 70s, there was a prolific industry in the Philippines
yeah.
of films is being turned out one after another. These you know, exploitation films. Roger Corman filmed a lot of his WIPs, Women in Prison.
Women in Prison, yeah.
The Big Birdcage, The Big Dollhouse, etc. They were filmed in the Philippines because...
it was a pretty versatile setting. You could lens things there and make it Vietnam, because
right?
obviously
yeah.
Vietnam is communist, couldn't go in there very easily.
Mm-hmm.
It could substitute for Hong Kong. It could substitute for... Well, California, Mexico, as it does here, I guess.
It substitutes for Mexico.
Yeah,
for sure, yeah.
It's,
but not California, but...
They
go to California, but it does substitute for Mexico.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think Strike Commando as well was filmed here.
Yeah.
And yeah. They just used Filipino extras as Vietnam soldiers, Vietnamese Viet Cong
yeah.
soldiers.
Yeah.
Who's going to know the difference on
yeah.
these shores?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing, too. I mean, like, with the Philippines in the 70s, it was a politically unstable country, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, at the same time, you know...
Who cares if they worked for cheap?
Exactly. Exploitation filmmakers would go in there, get, you know, a crew to work for peanuts. Not literal peanuts, but
maybe,
you know,
that too.
Maybe that too. And
if you,
know, you
want,
obviously, no
monkeys, you pay peanuts, as the phrase goes for hiring. I don't know.
No union, so mm-hmm. they'd, you know, they'd be willing to do, they'd work all throughout the night, and they'd be doing, you know, dangerous things. I mean, there were two camps of notable films in their lens in the Philippines in the 1970s. One camp was these schlocky exploitation films, right? Again, you know, your Cormans, your Santiago's, your Rene Cordova's, what have you. The other camp was Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Right? That was a Vietnam film that was made while the Vietnam War was still raging. Obviously, they couldn't film it in Vietnam, so they filmed it in the Philippines. And, I mean, there are two incredible documentaries out there about the film industry in the Philippines in the 70s. First one is called Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, all about the trials and tribulations into making Apocalypse Now. And I would say that that's almost as riveting as the actual film.
Oh, yeah.
And the second documentary is Machete Man's Unleashed. And this is all about making, you know, these exploitation films in the Philippines in the 70s. They interview lots of vets from the Filipino film industry. They interview one of the dudes in this movie, the guy who plays Morelli. We'll talk about Morelli in a moment or two. And they talk about Santiago, they talk about Corman. It's a great documentary. Totally recommend it. And another thing about the Philippines is, we reviewed a couple of movies on the site that were filmed in the Philippines. There
were it's a keyword that features prominently on our site, and then that's what sort of made us realize just how many pieces of schlock are filmed there. We reviewed, I guess, Firecracker and TNT Jackson.
Yep, TNT Jackson.
Both martial arts films featuring female leads, neither of whom had any business doing any martial arts whatsoever. And one of willingness to have her clothes ripped off in the middle of fight scenes was probably the reason she was cast. But
and TNT Jackson had a woman with a gigantic circumference afro. Right?
That's about it, yeah. And kicks that didn't, you know, approach anywhere near her assailants, but yeah. But
and drive a truck through, you know, her the assailant. And yeah, I mean, Santiago is, he's made movies like, you know, Cage Fury and Cage Heat 2.
Yeah.
And, I mean, on and on and on. I mean, the guy's extremely prolific. And so yeah, anytime you see a Zero Santiago, you know you're in for a good time. So now we're going to talk about Death Force. So
yeah, and as we said, a genre hopping Death Force. So we start off in vetsploitation territory where these guys are fresh off the Vietnam War, these three GIs,
yeah.
One of whom is Morelli, mm-hmm. the Italian with the stash,
yeah.
and his two afroed compatriots, McGee and...
Well, Morelli's got a bit of an afro as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, he does. You know, yeah, he's a white man's fro.
He's got a receding white man's fro, but anyway, yeah, he's got two brothers,
and the one guy is hell-bent on seeing his wife.
Yeah, Doug Russell, he's a family man, he wants to go back and see his wife, and his, unbeknownst to him, his wife is pregnant, so, he even has a son on the way, but he doesn't know that, but he just wants to go home and resume his life.
Hopefully it's his son. Go do the math backwards, 8 months.
Okay.
I guess he says, you know, that's the thing he's most excited about, seeing upon his return home. And his buddies there rudely say, oh, you're going to be sick of that broad or something. It's really rude.
Mm-hmm.
And they're way more interested not in resuming the life of a civilian in the United States, but they want to go deal cocaine in L.A.
Yeah.
And so that they, I guess they, but before that, I guess they meet in a bar that features hot women and cold beer.
My favorite type of bar.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Warm beer and cold women. Well, no, that sounds like
it's usually the
song.
Opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're in a bar, but anyway,
warm beer and cold
and,
women.
They hatch a plot, yeah. I guess, with some Filipinos to, yeah, they've stolen a bunch of stuff
from
Vietnam.
This is kind of ludicrous. Like, they steal a coffee.
They steal, like, lots of gold bars from Vietnam, and then they sell it, I guess, because they can't transport gold bars back to the U.S. of A.
Yeah.
And they sell all this gold to this Filipino gangster.
To Vic Diaz, who's played by Vic Diaz. Vic Diaz, I mean, this gentleman, the rotund, you know, poorly Vic Diaz. I mean, this guy is in like every movie that was made in the Philippines in the 70s, except for Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
He would have been great in Apocalypse Now. He would have probably been better than Marlon Brando, okay?
But, yeah.
I mean, he's always a
cherubic face, as you mentioned
there
earlier.
There you go. He would have been a great curse. But I mean, Vic Diaz, unfortunately, he's in this movie. Unfortunately, he's only in it for one scene.
And,
but,
and this gold is being, I guess, transported with via, you know, wooden coffins.
Yeah. But we're sort of getting ahead of ourselves because Russell, the man who wants to get back to his wife, he's not part of this this heist.
No, no.
He's basically washed up on a beach somewhere. Let's discuss how he got there.
Yeah, I guess as we've said in other podcasts, there's no honor among thieves. Mm-hmm. So his two compatriots decide to get a larger take of the money. So they, on a boat,
well, not even,
they decide to kill him.
Right. I don't even think Russell wanted to have anything to do with it. I mean, he was a family man. He just wanted to get back in the loving arms of his wife. You know, as James Ingram saying, if ever I'm in
well, I think the motivation for killing him would have been that. Otherwise, why would they bother killing
maybe,
him?
Unless maybe,
he would have turned them in. He was a good guy.
Yeah.
But I think they wanted their cut, from my understanding, as I was drifting in and out of consciousness through this thing. But yeah. They attempt to cut his throat. They gut him, and then they toss him overboard.
Right. No, but it's interesting. Morelli was the one, the Italian dude. I mean, he was the one that, like, he was the mastermind of this all. And he said to McGee, you know, we're going to have to kill we're going to have to kill Russell, Doug. And Russell goes, McGee goes, you want me to kill that brother? He goes,
yeah,
and
the only brother's on a dollar bill.
Yeah, he goes, don't kill that brother. The only brother is the one on the dollar bill, and he ain't black. So all of a sudden they assault poor Doug, and they slit his throat, and they just... Like,
and they leave him for dead? They flip him overboard?
They leave him for dead.
As well, very well, he should be dead.
Yes. But instead of that, he washes up on a beach somewhere, and this
somewhere couldn't have been... this any more ludicrous.
This is ridiculous.
This is like some Gilligan's Island shit here.
Yeah.
This island, off the coast of the Philippines, is inhabited by a duo.
Of Japanese
soldiers.
From World War II. They've been marooned there, missing for the past 30 years.
Yeah, they have bayonets. They are Imperial Japanese soldiers from World War II.
And we say Japanese in air quotes, because...
Yeah, I guess we could discuss a little bit of identity politics here, because, we always get the impression that, you know, white people are the only racists, and we always hear about blackface, which was that, you know, awful, like, Spike Lee devoted a film to it about how in the 1920s and 30s, mm-hmm. sort of the vaudeville, the Al Jolson era, white guys would dress up with black face paint and do this awful, like, shuck and drive routine. Mm-hmm. And we thought, okay, you know, maybe white people have a lot to answer for. And now these white people, and we're not talking Caucasians, these are Japanese people who are painted white. They're Filipino actors.
Filipino actors.
And this was mind-boggling. I think I texted you at this point and said, there's Filipinos painted to look like Japanese. We couldn't, like... I feel less guilty about, you know, white racism at this point.
And it's so funny because...
My God.
Of these two, I mean, one of them, you know...
the white is only on his face.
Well, yeah, the white, but I was going to say, like, I mean, you know, like, God bless the guy, he tried, but I mean, his you know, he's saying a lot, he's like, he won't wax wrong, you know, like, you know, really, like, awful, like, and, but at least you can understand what he was saying, whereas the other guy was completely
incomprehensible. Unintelligible, yeah.
I mean, he kept talking about committing, you know, the honorable art of, we say it's a harikuri, but it's also referred to as seppuku, right?
Seppuku, yeah, which we heard as serpico. This guy's like a marble mouth.
Yeah, why do you want to commit serpico? I mean,
Al Pacino. Yeah, where's Al Pacino?
You know what I mean? Yes, there is somebody from The Godfather in this movie. The actor who plays Morelli was in Godfather 2, but I mean...
I guess it's just sort of a provincial attitude we have about racism, because racism is obviously worldwide, and the Japanese hate the Chinese, and their stereotypes that exist. Hell, between, what is it, the Cambodians and the Thais? The Laotians and the Thais? The Thais don't like people from Laos because they think they're a bunch of backward hicks, and they make fun of the way they look and talk, and just, all right, this, you know, ethnic, you know, acrimony and racial strife is a worldwide phenomenon, sadly.
Yeah.
But these guys, yeah, my God.
So
they haven't seen a visitor in 30 years. On this island.
I mean, it's so ludicrous because, I mean, they've been washed up on this island and
they still wear all their Imperial Army gear.
Yeah,
and they have a Japanese. Where did they get the Japanese flag? I don't know. They have all these. They have like a bamboo hut and all this accoutrements. They might as well be making sushi on this island. But yeah, they have their bayonets. They have their uniforms, and then they see this Russell wash up on the beach, worse for wear, as his throat has been slit and his gut has been gouged, and they grab him by the arms and they drag him up on the beach, mm-hmm. and he, you know, they help him.
They nurse him
recuperate.
Back to health, and they it's funny too, because I mean, again, like the comprehensible Japanese soldier at one point says, "If he dies, I get bit back." You know what I mean? Like, it's just so awful, but I mean, so awfully incredible as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean.
And he also says, we're apologies here. Why can't we get a case of wine to wash up instead of a body? You know?
Yeah,
that's a fair question.
A case of wine or
rice.
A bag of rice.
Yeah.
And then they're having these arguments over, like, who's the emperor and who's the whatever. Anyhow, and then.
Yeah, these guys don't know what year it is. So then this Russell comes too. And he's, you know, he's convalescing there, and he's, you know, he's in and out of consciousness, and he says, Mother Humpers,
yeah.
Which I've never heard before. Usually the blaxploitation is motherfuckers.
Yeah.
And these guys are, you know, nonplussed by this guy's use, as were we, by the term Mother Humpers.
Right.
And they're going, oh, my English, have you heard that? I don't know what a Mother Humper is.
He says, speak English, but not the Bremen. I've heard before.
And they, you know, they, I guess they ask him what year it is. They don't know what year it is.
Mm-hmm.
They make small talk with him. They
say,
"Oh, Joe DiMaggio." Yeah, these guys are Japanese, so obviously they love baseball. And they ask him about Joe DiMaggio. Joe DiMaggio, the ex-Bronx Bomber, mm-hmm. Yankee great, obviously dated Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
We looked it up.
He had his baseball career in the
30s. In the 30s, yeah. So these guys have had no contact with the outside world since the end of the war. And so they think that, you know, Joe DiMaggio is still, you know, playing. But this is, again, 30 years hence. What do they know? The passage of time is very illusory for these two Japanese Filipino guys.
So now we have these two concurrent tales happening. And one of them is in Los Angeles. And this is the rise to power of Morelli and McGee as they overtake the
most ineffectual mafia in L.A.
But, I mean, and this reminded me completely of another film I reviewed on the site, Massacre Mafia Style.
Yes.
Where these two Italian, well, one of them is Italian Mimi, and then he goes back to the States, he meets up with his friend Jolly, and they just take over the Los Angeles Underground like a hot knife through butter. Like,
yeah.
No resistance whatsoever. Same with these guys. Like, it's just like, there's like nothing, there's no, like, you know, going to the mattresses, there's no war. It's like all of a sudden, it's like, oh, you
these don't two wanna... guys who've been in Vietnam for years, and they just show up, gun down everybody, and no one knows who they are, and they just suddenly, they're the top dogs.
Yep.
And they're the ones who take over the local trattoria that serves up lasagna. And they take out the prevailing mafiosi there with
the
Tommy guns.
Oh yeah,
with Tommy guns.
That's another thing too.
Like, it's like Al Capone.
Like, is this 1930? Maybe it really is 1930. Like, it's all of a sudden, it's like they're coming there with Tommy guns.
Yeah, it's a homage to Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah, exactly. And then of course they take over the protection racket. And they're saying, you know, you can either pay in money or you can pay in blood.
You can pay in blood, or we don't spend blood. Yeah.
Great lines, I gotta say. So as there, and of course, then we have Russell, and he's on the island, and he wants
two things. Yeah.
He wants to get back home,
yes.
And he wants revenge, right? Mm-hmm.
So, and while he's convalescing, like, he's making miraculous recovery,
mm-hmm.
and they start training him in the ways of the Shogun samurai arts, and he obviously, he's impressed by their ability to chop coconuts. With samurai swords. So he says, oh, can I get in on that action?
Yeah.
So then they start this ludicrous montage where they're pitching him coconuts.
Yeah.
I guess the baseball theme. They're pitching him coconuts and he's swinging and missing. Like, I guess the Jays starting lineup these days. And he's... But eventually, under the tutelage of these two guys who they speak in aphorisms such as, you do not become a man before you first become a child. And you're a disciple now. You have to seek to master yourself. And all these, like, Mr. Miyagi.
All these Miyagi-isms,
And then, he becomes incredibly prolific with the samurai sword.
Yeah, no, it's like, literally in 2 days, it's like samurai boot camp, you know? He becomes, like, you know, master samurai, and
I think Sylvester Stallone became a country singer in less time.
In Rhinestone,
Dolly Parton.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
Yeah, in 2 days, they're offering him like his own sword and his own like weird choker.
Which he wears for the duration of the film. It's very distracting, in my opinion. Especially considering he got his throat slit, and that was like a choker.
Yeah. And I guess so. Obviously, he wants to exact revenge, and I guess for some reason, there's, I don't know whether there was, you know, some search party, like a military crew, like a Filipino military crew comes by the island, and what bad luck these two Japanese guys have, because they've been there for 30 years, and not a soul has passed. Mm-hmm. But as soon as this brother ends up on the island, the army is there looking around and checking things out. Before we go on, I guess one of the Japanese dudes, who's rather aged.
Yeah, and he's always singing like these very stereotypical Japanese songs.
Yeah. We are doing it justice there. Yeah. And that guy ends up dead.
Just dead. Yeah. No reason given. He's just there. And I could buy that he might have died of natural causes. He was aged, but his face was all bloody and shit. So, like...
Yeah, it made me wonder if
was there a scene cut or something? Yeah. Or, they fall on a rock? Or maybe one of the coconuts bonked him in the head or something? I don't know, but...
So, yeah, you get this search party goes out and, finds... You know, happens upon them. And the Japanese guy hightails it into the brush, and the Russell, the Afro'd Russell, just basically gives himself up.
He surrenders, yeah.
He surrenders, and then he goes over to try and get his Japanese friend to just say, hey, the gig is up. And this guy obviously says, you know, there's no honor among that, mm-hmm. you know, for doing that, and he commits
Serpico.
Hoo-ha! Like becoming, you know, Al Pacino. Yeah. But he commits suicide, and they, I guess, take Russell off the island.
And they bring it, and then that's his ticket back to the States.
And that's his ticket back to the U.S. of A.
Yep. So, yeah, so now we have the newly,
newly Asian minted samurai.
Samurai, yeah, Russell. And he's, as soon as he gets off the plane, he's in a cab. And, of course, his cab driver happens to be Japanese.
Yeah, and he starts speaking Japanese.
He's fluent Japanese.
He's been on that island a month.
Yeah. So, you know, basically by, slicing a few coconuts that were still in the air, he becomes a master samurai and a fluent Japanese speaker. Go figure. Anyhow,
and at the, you know, while this is all going on, his widow, well, and obviously she's not a widow because he's not dead, but she has been informed of his demise by the guy who tried to kill Russell. And he comes in and, you know, says, you know, he tries to put the moves on her.
This is McGee, yeah.
This is McGee, and she's a nightclub singer with a cute little kid with a giant afro who plays the guitar. It's a great actor. Yeah, he was always looking in the right direction of the camera, which couldn't be said for the other members of the cast. Yeah. And, you know, she's a nightclub act, and she performs at venues such as Dino's Nightclub, so she's sort of tangentially related to the Los Angeles, you know, underworld, criminal underworld. So, anyway, back to Russell. He's put up in, I guess, a cousin or something of the cab driver's place, the Japanese cab driver, and, you know, he gets ready to try and track down the guys who did him wrong.
Yeah, and he basically cuts a swath of destruction through the LA underworld looking for Morelli and McGee. And, you know, you got your sword fights, you got your dismemberments, your disembowelings, you got your... there was this one fight, Russo. Russo was, I guess, the right-hand man of Morelli, right?
Yeah, he's one of the... Or is it Rico? I don't know. There's so many Italian stereotypes to go around. Like, yeah. No race comes off good in this one.
I don't know.
Yeah. And Rico looked, he's you know, a little bit like a Freddie Prinze Jr. Mm-hmm. This is most a little bit like the Beastie Boys Sabotage video. Just a ludicrous mustache that you look like you could just tear it off.
Yeah.
It was just...
Yeah, and him and Doug, they had this pretty awesome fight in a barber shop. I just felt bad for the poor barber. He's like this elderly barber, and you know, all of a sudden,
collateral damage to poor shopkeeps in action films.
Yeah,
is no beyond the pale.
About this stuff.
I hope they're I hope they're insured.
Owner, you know, he's giving a haircut to Doug, and then before then this guy's got to come in with...
Before you know it, yeah, the mafia is on his doorstep.
And one is thrown through the window, whatever, he's demolished,
Rule of action films, if there's a window nearby, someone has to be thrown through it.
Exactly.
Or in the case of RoboCop, someone thrown through it, five times?
Exactly, yeah.
Got to make use of that plastic glass.
Yeah. So, Russell is, slowly making his way through the underworld, and he's cutting and slicing and dicing.
Yeah, slicing and dicing. Yeah,
with his Ginsu samurai sword, and so Morelli's men are starting to get understandably worried, and they're starting to
desert.
Gone.
Yeah, like rats from the sinking ship.
And
there.
Then it comes down to just basically Russo, McGee, and Morelli, mm-hmm. and he descends upon McGee.
Yeah, and McGee, he Van Goghs McGee.
He lops off the guy's ear.
Yeah.
So let me just click my thoughts for one second. Okay, he didn't cut off his entire ear. He cut off the tip, okay?
Yeah, well.
Now, you cut off the tip of somebody's ear. Does that require an inpatient hospitalization stay of a week or something?
Not for Evander Holyfield when Mike Tyson bit his ear off in the prize fight. But
there you go.
Yeah, he was kept in the hospital for several days.
So he's in the hospital, and this hospital, it looked ludicrous. It looked like a child's bedroom,
yellow wallpaper,
exactly.
Yellow bed, no nurses.
Cheap ass exploitation film, are there ever any? No ID drip, nothing.
We've seen this a thousand times.
So, but he does get a box. He gets a gift, and he
what could
up.
Be in that box?
Yeah,
seven guesses.
Well,
yeah, like the movie
bear?
Seven. Yeah,
the teddy bear, perhaps.
Yeah,
box of chocolates.
No,
it's Morelli's head.
Yeah.
So now it's down to
now it's.
It's that mano a mano. And we should say also that, I think you did say that McGee took a liking to...
To the missus.
Yeah.
Yeah, so who he thought was a widow. Yeah.
So he kidnaps him, and they escape to Mexico. And now we're back in the Philippines. And this is Mexico.
And we can tell it's Mexico because a donkey walked by
with a kid wearing a sombrero running a burro.
Smacks of authenticity.
Yeah, we know we're in Mexico, right?
Someone could have been drinking a bottle of Sol or something,
Yeah, they might as well have had a mariachi band in the background, it comes down to Russo invading, not Russo, I'm sorry, Russell invading the compound, and it's a decapitation fest, man. It's awesome.
Yeah, all of McGee's henchmen are being just gutted, and their heads being sent flying. At one point, there was three of the henchmen get decapitated, and their heads are put on stakes, like the Tower of London or something.
Or Vlad the Impaler,
And McGee, I guess, takes the guy's wife and young son a hostage. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's...
Yeah, it comes down to that. He's like, sorry, I'm going to
the showdown at the end.
That's the showdown, and, as we have our mano a mano fight, McGee versus Russell, fucking awesome. Russell sticks him with a samurai sword and hoists him over
his head, yeah, like a parasol.
But, and then we're like, we're already, okay, I don't want to spoil the ending, but I mean, this was like
a downer.
It was a fun B-movie, and we're just waiting for this triumphant, heart-swelling reunion between Russell, his wife, and his kid.
His cute little kid,
And then something happens, I don't want to say, I don't want to spoil it. We've spoiled about 99.9% of this movie. I don't want to say it, but man, what a downer ending. It kind of left us stunned just a wee bit,
yeah.
I would say.
Which is good, I guess, because we feel like we've seen it all, and I didn't see that one coming.
No, neither did I.
No foreshadowing, maybe a little bit.
This guy seemed a little
corrupt, but not the way we thought. So, review.
Okay, well, first of all...
Star rating.
Before we give a star rating, what did you learn from... of the three titles?
Vengeance
Death Force,
is Mine.
Vengeance is Mine, Fighting Mad. Well, I learned, for one thing, that Japanese soldiers circa World War II were huge Joe DiMaggio fans. That was one thing. Because, they were obsessed with Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah.
Another thing I learned, too, is
I guess I learned that they didn't seem overly concerned about being marooned on this island. Like he said, they have The guy actually made a little speech. You'd think, okay, lack of companionship, women folk, lack of maybe seeing your family, creature comforts of living in a westernized country or modern country. No, it's like, we have food here, we have sun, he said at one point. These are the two whitest guys ever. And they didn't seem to mind that they were stuck with just each other's company on this island. So that's what I learned. I think I would want off the island after about 2 weeks, maybe a week.
I don't think I'd want to be stuck with you on an island. No.
Yeah, there's only so many podcasts we could record before we'd be at each other's throats. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I learned that to become a master samurai warrior, I mean, we've seen white samurais and samurai cop, and now we see a black samurai, and what I've learned is that all it takes is one guy flinging coconuts in the air, and you slice him. And not only that, but you will... through osmosis, learn fluent Japanese.
Yes, so this is true. Which is weird, is they never foreshadowed his conversation with the LA cab driver.
Because he never spoke Japanese on the island, did he? No.
Nor did the two Japanese guys speak any Japanese. Although at times we thought they did, as they were completely incomprehensible.
Right.
And at the time, I don't know if I... maybe I was going to text you this, but it was like, I could not understand it, and I thought there was something wrong with the DVD. Like, maybe I should have gotten the subtitles going, but yeah, and then I figured, oh, that is English.
Yeah.
Like, the Serpico thing really floored me. I didn't know what was going on there.
Oh, man, it's like, a star rating, eh?
Three and a half for me. This is incredibly fun. Probably a little bit of pacing issues to bump it up to about a 4.
Yeah, it was overlong.
Three and a half for sure.
I'm going to give it a 3.5.
Fun as hell.
Yeah, I recommend this. This is
lots of polyester, lots of wide lapels, giant afros, ass beat downs, like
terrible
casual
decor,
casual racism. The best kind.
Oh.
No nudity, shockingly.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually a staple of blaxploitation, especially kung fu during fight scenes. A woman's got to have her top ripped off, as we discussed earlier. But it was kind of tame. Mm. Although toward the end, the decapitations just sort of out of nowhere, just a bloodbath.
Yep, with some arterial spray as well. Solid 3.5 for me.
Yeah.
And this is great. So I'm actually looking forward to
Vampire Hookers.
Checking out the second half of this double bill,
another
Santiago film starring the great John Carradine.
Yeah, and the famous Carradine acting
dynasty
fraternal foursome.
And that sort of goes because, well, you know, of course, David Carradine played in Kung Fu.
I mean,
he was of the, you know, and so
Kill Bill, everything comes together.
Everything comes together. So, for more, check out
www.reallyawfulmovies.com, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.